we have to judge them for them because we're smarter. Take, say, Reinhold Niebuhr, who was the guru of the Kennedy intellectuals and George Kennan and that sort of, you know, Arthur Schlesinger and those people. His view was that what he called the cool observers, you know, that's the responsible men. Rationality, he said, belongs to the cool observers, small group of people. And their job is to produce necessary illusions and emotionally potent oversimplifications in order to keep the general public kind of on course, you know, sort of. That's and it's very hard to find any deviation from this. Now, notice that there's always one question that's never asked. It's quite important in a doctrinal system never to ask certain questions. It's, again, the thief-thief issue. One question that's not asked, say, by Walter Lippmann, is why he's a member of the responsible men, why Eugene Debs is in jail, say. I mean, how did that happen? You know, how come Eugene Debs is in jail while I'm one of the responsible men? Is it that I'm smarter or something like that? Well, I mean, there's an obvious answer to that question. The obvious answer is they have a different constituency. Walter Lippmann and Reinhold Niebuhr and Harold Lasswell and the rest are serving the interests of people with real power. Eugene Debs was a leading labor leader, so he's in jail, you know, for raising some questions about the First World War, which is plainly not allowed in a free society. And in fact, the responsible men or the men of virtue or whatever they call themselves, they are in effect managers. If they do their job, they can stay in. They don't do their job, they go out, just like the manager of a corporation. You can say, I've got all the power, but just try to do something that'll lower profits, you know, like try to improve conditions for the workers or something like that. You'll be out in 3 seconds, you know, because your job is to serve the people with real power. But in the ideological institutions, you're not allowed to raise this question. It's a mistake to raise the question, just as it would be a mistake to raise the possibility that truisms about the media might be true. You don't want to allow these issues to be thought about or discussed and so on. They should be off the agenda. That's the theory of democracy, and there's reasoning behind it. I've been quoting from the public record. If you look at the private internal record, this is a very free society, you know, by comparative standards. So we have quite a good declassified record of internal, you know, what was actually going on inside. You can find a lot of stuff. And you find what people really thought. And it's interesting to see what they really thought. It turns out to be not very different from, in fact, kind of identical to the 17th century when they were fuming about the rascal multitude and the beasts in men's shape and, you know, all of this kind of business. So take, say, Woodrow, we'll just keep to the liberals, take Woodrow Wilson, who's the leading progressive president, you know. He and his Secretary of State, Robert Lansing, were quite exercised. They were upset about the Bolshevik Revolution, naturally. In fact, that set off the Cold War. Cold War started in 1917, not 1945. And what was it that bothered them about the Soviets? Well, you know, it wasn't that Russia was going to conquer the world. I mean, whatever you think about post-1945 period, nobody thought that Russia was aggressive between 1917 and 1945. Not even the most utter madman claimed that. But they were very much afraid of them, and they followed a containment policy. In fact, we supported Mussolini's fascism. We even supported Hitler pretty openly, in fact, because of the danger of Russia. So it was really a pretty dangerous thing. Well, what was the danger? Well, Robert Lansing, Woodrow Wilson's Secretary of State, explained it. This is around 1918. He said, the Bolsheviks are appealing to the proletariat of all nations, to the ignorant and mentally deficient, who by their very numbers are urged to become masters. A very real danger in view of the process of social unrest throughout the world, okay? In other words, the problem with the Bolsheviks is that they're appealing to the ignorant and mentally deficient, to what Lippmann publicly at the time called the ignorant and meddlesome majority. And they're saying, you guys ought to be the masters of the world. In fact, they weren't, but that's the way it looked from Washington, you know. They were afraid that they were making that appeal, and that's, we got to stop that. That's just dangerous. Woodrow Wilson was afraid that soldiers coming back from the war would have funny ideas in their head that they were picking up in Europe, where there were workers' councils being established in Germany and Italy and so on. He was even afraid that workers here might start asking for representation on a board of management. He was particularly afraid about blacks coming back, black soldiers. He said they're really getting funny ideas. As he put it, already, he said, I've heard that Negro laundresses are asking their mistresses for more money, claiming the money's as much mine as yours. You know, boy, we got to put a stop to this, you know. So therefore, we have to really you know, invade Russia, which they did. They took it pretty seriously. The British, for example, used poison gas, which at that time was like nuclear weapons. And it was no joke. And then comes an embargo and everything else. Well, so it continues. The threat was throughout the whole official Cold War, post-1945. It's the same story. You look at the secret planning documents from, say, around 1945, when it's still an alliance, technically. So July 1945, there's a major study of the War Department, which is now called the Defense Department, and the State Department on the post-war world. This is July 45. You know, we're still at war. We're still in alliance with the Russians. And they discuss the problems of the future world. And they say the big problem is that there is a rising tide all over the world wherein the common man is seeking broader horizons, broader and wider horizons. That's the problem of the world. Now, where do the Russians fit in? Well, they say there is as yet no proof that the Russians have flirted with the thought of associating themselves with this, but they might. You know, the Russians haven't proven yet that they aren't flirting with the thought of associating themselves with this rising tide all over the world wherein the common man is seeking broader and wider horizons. So therefore, we can't take any chances. We got to go right after them, you know, surround them with military bases. They recognize that the position they were taking, namely that the U.S. has to ring Russia with military bases and close them off even from their only access to warm water port at the Dardanelles, whereas the Russians aren't allowed anything, they recognize that this looks illogical. But they said it's a logical illogicality. One of my favorite phrases. It's a logical illogicality because the Russians haven't yet demonstrated that they're not flirting with this dangerous thought of associating themselves with this rising tide and so on of the common man. And so it continues. I mean, you go to, say, the internal private discussions between, say, Eisenhower and Dulles 10 years later. Eisenhower complains about, he said, the mass appeal of the communists, a big problem. It's something we can't duplicate. And the reason is they appeal to the masses, and we don't have any way of doing that. We can't appeal to the masses. And Dulles, Secretary of State, chimes in and says, yeah, he said, they're appealing to the poor people of the world who have always wanted to plunder the rich. So that's the big problem of history, is all these poor people trying to plunder the rich, and the communists are appealing to them, and we don't have any way of duplicating that because we can't appeal to people on the basis of our principle that the rich ought to plunder the poor. Somehow it doesn't seem to appeal to people. You never quite figure out why. So there is this mass appeal of the communists. We got to do something about it. If we can't, you know, since we can't do it doctrinally, we'll just use force. You know, so like throw out the government of Guatemala, which is what was in discussion at the time, and so on. The classified record, we don't have it for the last 20 or 30 years, but I'm sure you'll find exactly the same thing. This is the consistent thinking right through, goes right back to the 17th century, and it always has the same reasoning behind it. The reasoning is wealth and power are narrowly concentrated, and that's right and just, naturally. And therefore, the people who work for those with wealth and power must be virtuous, by definition. And everybody else who's trying to plunder the rich must be, you know, as Lansing put it, ignorant and mentally deficient. Otherwise, how could they try to do this? And we've got to, therefore, keep them out of trouble by keeping them spectators, not participants. Well, that's the underlying theory, which sort of reinforces a natural expectation about the media, and it adds another bit of coloration to what a reasonable person would expect, namely that I was talking about the agenda-setting media before for the elites, who just have to be indoctrinated in the right beliefs. But what about the ignorant and meddlesome majority? Well, they have to be diverted somehow. I mean, true, you can give them emotionally potent oversimplifications and necessary illusions and that kind of thing, so they should be able to parrot the party line. But the main thing is just keep them out of trouble. You know, let them do anything that doesn't matter. Okay, so let them scream about football teams or sex comedies or whatever. So what you want to do is create a system in which each individual is just kind of like glued to the tube. That's important. It's a well-known principle of totalitarian cultures that you want to isolate people. And this is discussed as far back as the 18th century. And they didn't call it totalitarian in those days. But then what we call a totalitarian culture, it's extremely important to separate people from one another. Because when the ignorant and mentally deficient majority get together, they sometimes get funny ideas. But if you can keep people alone, it doesn't really matter much if they think or what they think. So keep people isolated in a modern period. That means looking at the tube, which is a perfect device, and you're completely passive, and pay attention to something completely meaningless, which has no effect on anything, and intersperse it with the proper messages. Now, for the ignorant and meddlesome majority, the proper message is be obedient, be a consumer, purchase all kind of junk you don't need, like your kid in the ghetto, you know, get $200 sneakers because, you know, Magic Johnson is wearing them or something like that. And don't bother anybody, you know. I mean, if you want to go kill the kid next door, that's okay. That doesn't bother us. But don't bother people by, say, trying to plunder the rich. Just plunder each other, you know, like inside the ghetto. That's the trick. That's what you would predict the media would be. Well, you know, you can take a look at the sitcoms and figure out how true it is. I don't think there's very much question about the truth of it at the level of mass popular culture. And this is thought about. It's thought about. I mean, the public relations industry does not spend over $1 billion a year for fun. The public relations industry was created, and it's an American invention, was created in the early part of the century, as its leaders put it, to control the public mind, which they said is the greatest danger facing corporations. And you got to control the public mind. And these are the natural ways to do it. And they're the ways which we in fact see. And as far as more elite elements are concerned, you've got to sort of indoctrinate them so they look at the world the right way. And there'll be men of virtue who know which interests to serve, and not the interests of working people like Eugene Debs, who just didn't get educated properly, but the ones who make it, you know who's on the right side and serve their interests. There are always new methods introduced to do this, more sophisticated methods. I mean, one of the interesting aspects of U.S. history that sort of marks it off a little from other industrial societies is the extreme class consciousness of the business classes. You read the business literature, it's straight vulgar Marxist. All the values inverted, of course, but it's all full of, you know, the rising power of the masses and, you know, this and that and the other thing. And you've got to just, it kind of reads like a, you know, a Maoist tract, except with the values inverted, and you got to stop these guys, you know, just like the poor who are trying to plunder the rich. And it is very class conscious. It's been aware for a long time that it doesn't have the mechanisms to control by force. To a large extent, it did. So, for example, take labor history in the United States. It's unusually violent. Well, the United States has the most violent labor history of any industrial society. In the early part of this century, about 700, well, nobody knows the numbers because nobody's counted them up, but at least 700 workers were murdered on strikes by police and army at a time when nobody was being killed in Europe. You know, in fact, the rights that American workers finally got in the 1930s had already been achieved in Europe 50, 60 years earlier. In fact, the right-wing European press, you know, say in England, was appalled by the way American workers were being treated through this period. So there was plenty of violence, but not enough to really control people. And therefore, it was necessary to control opinion. It was necessary to do extensive indoctrination. And it runs right up to the present. If you look at the way the media work, you see this, particularly the media that are directed to mass popular audiences, like television and that kind of thing. They are very carefully crafted to have these effects. Keep people spectators, not participants. Keep them isolated. Keep them engaged in things that aren't going to get them have any funny ideas about plundering the rich. Keep them scared. You don't have to keep them frightened. So we have continual enemies about to overwhelm us, and we all cower in terror, and then our great leader rescues us just in the nick of time. I mean, all of this is pretty standard stuff. I mean, we've been going through this farce for the last 10 years, every year or two. But just keep them scared, keep them quiet, keep them consuming, you know, as they buy all kind of junk they don't need, and keep them separated from one another so they never get together. One of the reasons why it's been so important to destroy unions is that unions are the classic device by which people get together, poor people get together. I mean, it's not just that they work for working conditions. They work for democracy, which is a terrible threat because what you want to do is block democracy. The whole point of democratic theory and practice is to try to prevent democracy from functioning because it's not allowed to function. It's a threat. And this is understood. Every time there's an upsurge of popular groups, you get a very sharp reaction. It usually happens during times of crisis. So wars typically get people thinking, you know. And every time there's a war or something like that, it's followed by a period of repression. The First World War aroused these problems that Lansing and Wilson were worried about. you know, these soldiers coming back with funny ideas, or, you know, the Negro laundress is asking for money and that sort of thing. And it was followed by a very brutal, harsh repression. I mean, like, it's not gas chambers, but the Wilson's Red Scare was extremely repressive. They destroyed unions. They destroyed independent thought. They kicked a couple of thousand people out of the country. Laws were thrown out the window. I mean, the principle of Wilson's liberal attorney general, Palmer, was we cannot wait until laws are broken. It's too late. We have to go after these guys first before they do anything. It was very effective in deadening the country for about 10 years. During the 1930s, again, a lot of popular ferment developed. You know, CIOs getting organized, all kind of things happening. In 1935, labor won its first legislative victory, real legislative victory, also its last, you know. Namely, the Wagner Act was passed, and it gave the right to organize. It caused tremendous fear in the business community. You read the National Association of Manufacturers, they talk again, you know, the rising power of the masses. It's a great hazard facing industrialists. We have to do something to counter it. They moved very quickly, didn't waste any time. Within a year or two, steel strikes were being broken by violence again. You know, workers were getting killed in the little steel strikes. But more interesting than that, they started with what are called scientific methods of management. A whole new set of devices was developed. Scientific methods of management, ways of bringing about what's called harmony between workers and bosses, showing we're all on the same side, you know. So you skim off the elements of the labor leadership, which are maybe rising. You bring them to places like Harvard. You teach them how to drink port and have the right ideas and that kind of stuff. And that's, you have to sort of socialize them into the upper class, and they're not going to cause any problems. And this was also used for strike breaking. The scientific methods of strike breaking were also developed at that time. It was understood that you have to saturate the media, saturate the community with a set of beliefs which was designed. It was tried in Johnstown, Pennsylvania, at the steel strikes around 1936-37. It was extremely successful. It's ever since been called the Mohawk Valley formula. The idea was to go into a community where there's a strike, saturate the community through the media, through the churches, everywhere, with the picture that there's two groups, two antagonistic groups, us and them, okay? Us is, you know, the worker on the job with his pail, the housewife taking care of her house, the executive slaving 20 hours a day to help the people, and so on and so forth. That's us, you know. And then there's them. Them is these outsiders, aliens, you know, anarchists, disruptive elements, union leaders, you know, coming from somewhere to try to disrupt our harmony and our peace and our togetherness. And we got to protect ourselves.
This is David Barsamyan of Alternative Radio asking you to support independent KPFK. And you can do that very simply by calling 818-985-5735, option 2, to donate. I'm joined by my good friend and colleague, Beto Arcos. Beto, great to see you.
It's so great to be with you, David. Such a treat to talk to. You know, I have to say this, David. You've been my mentor for a long time. You know, you taught me about radio. I'll never forget something you said to me. Beto, you know, you have to put your personality in there. We want to hear what you sound like. We want to hear your voice. It doesn't matter if you have an accent. It's important that people hear who you are. You don't have to fake it. You have to be yourself. That's what you taught me back in the mid-1980s in Boulder, Colorado, when I was starting my radio career. Because really, I have to say, too, that I learned how to do radio at the studios of KGNU when the studios were, you know, on Broadway in a small little second floor where you could smell the grease from the restaurant below. It was such a special place, you know, for me. I always reminisce about those days. And of course, later on, you also recommended me to work at KPFK and start doing radio at a big market such as Los Angeles. So here we are, many years later, together again, asking our listeners to support Alternative Radio, this program that David Barsamyan has produced for decades, bringing us voices such as Barbara Enright, Michael Parenti, Noam Chomsky that we're listening to in the past hour. All these amazing voices that tell it like it is, that speak truth to power, that say the things that must be said when things are dire, when things are difficult, when things are happening and you're not hearing it in the mainstream media. Because the reality is that there are a lot of things that are left unsaid, that are left unchecked. And this is where alternative radio, this is where KPFK, this is where Pacifica come in and say, listen up, this is really what's happening. 818-985-5735 is the number. You can also go to the website, kpfk.org/donate. We'll send you Bob Dylan's Through the Open Window set, a compilation of music from the Bootleg Series, Volume 18. Once again, 818-985-5735.
And, you know, you get not only the Dylan box set, but you get the satisfaction of having done something for your community. You know, you hear this word a lot, community, particularly from the right wing. But in fact, you know, you are our community. We depend on you. That's why we're asking you to step up right now and give us a call and pledge what you can. It's really important that we hear from you at 818-985-5735. Press 2 to donate, 818-985-KPFK. And I do want to mention that the station also has a campaign to get 500 new sustainers before the end of the year. This is a really important project to give the station the kind of financial stability that it needs to continue its work. So think about that as well. Give what you can, but we do need to hear from you. That's the critical point we're making. 818-985-5735, option 2 to donate, or go to kpfk.org online. And, you know, really, you've done your part for your community, for Southern California. KPFK has this tremendous signal that goes north, south, east, west. Can't go too far west because you'll be in the water. But, you know, it's a remarkable radio station. Beto, you've had so much to do with its growth and expansion and becoming even more diverse and more connected with communities, not just in Southern California, but Beto, particularly from your work from Latin America, from the Caribbean, and from other parts of the world. So it's a very special station, and we're asking you now to step up and get the Bob Dylan set. I mean, these are extraordinary recordings. I mean, you talk about bootleg, informal gatherings in friends' apartments, outtakes made at Columbia Records, never released, never heard. You know, today we had Noam Chomsky on. In many ways, Noam Chomsky and Bob Dylan are quite connected in their rebellion, in their insistence on truth and going forward and avoiding the propaganda. So the Dylan-Chomsky connection is real. I'm making it here. I think this is a time to step up. Give us a call. Get these classic recordings you've never heard before available right now, if you call 818-985-5735, option 2 to donate.
818-985-5735 is the number. You touched on something really important, David, and something that I learned at KGNU in Boulder back in the day when I started doing radio. And it continues to be the case at KPFK. Community. What is a community? What is building community? Building community is supporting the local that gives you what you don't get anywhere else. In this case, this radio station that's been beaming all kinds of voices, alternative voices, voices that you don't hear in the mainstream media. They've been beaming here for years and years. Chris Hedges, one of the most credible voices in the collection, in the catalog that AR has been offering here on this radio station for many years. Noam Chomsky, someone that I remember someone commenting back in the day, David, at the University of Veracruz when I was studying there back in the 80s. I remember people referring to Chomsky as a linguist. It wasn't until I landed in Boulder years later that I heard Noam Chomsky, and I said to myself, is that the same guy, Noam Chomsky? And then he said, yeah, he's a linguist, but he's also a very illuminated person on the matters of the world, on political affairs. David, I remember you asked me to introduce you, because then you introduced Noam Chomsky at Boulder High School. Yeah. That speech that he came to Boulder to give back in the, it must have been in the late 1980s or something. What an opportunity to be there and to shake hands. It was long before selfies, long before, you know, cell phones. I don't even think I took a picture with him, but it doesn't matter. I have that memory in me because of you, David. Thank you so much. 818-985-5735 is the number to call.
And you can hear voices like Bill McKibben, you know, who really has no equal in terms of the eco-crisis and describing what needs to be done to reverse what's happening around the world with the climate emergency. People like Nader Hashemi, you haven't heard his name. A remarkable Canadian-Iranian-American who's done great scholarship on the crisis with Iran and the ongoing sanctions that the U.S. has imposed. Arundhati Roy of India, Vandana Shiva, Fatima Bhutto of Pakistan, Claudia de la Cruz of the Bronx, New York, of Eduardo Galeano of Uruguay. Great, great voices that you can hear on alternative radio. Jesse Hagopian on the war on education, what's happening there. All these voices are made possible because you have supported independent KPFK. As I said many times, we're connected by this electronic umbilical cord. We need you, you need us. And we're happy to be here for you. And right now, we're asking you to be there for us by calling 818-985-5735. 818-985-5735. Get this incredible Bob Dylan set. I've been told by the station manager that this is the hot premium of this membership drive. This is the one that's going like hotcakes. So don't be left aside. Get your copy right now. Do it very simply. Call 818-985-5735. Option 2 to donate or go to kpfk.org. But please support independent KPFK.
818-985-5735. We're also looking for new sustaining members. 500 folks before the end of the year. That means $10 per month or $20 per month, whatever you can do, but to be, you know, a sustainer member, someone that maintains and keeps supporting the radio station into the coming year so that there is a solid amount of funding that helps the station stay alive and stay strong. 818-985-5735 or kpfk.org/donate. And as David said, the hot premium of the fund drive is Bob Dylan's Bootleg Series, Volume 18, Through the Open Window. These are the years, as they're called, the sort of the emerging years or the years of the emerging voice that we know as Bob Dylan. There's even stuff here, David, where his name was Robert Zimmerman, where he was Bob Zimmerman playing, you know, in Minnesota in a little club. There's some incredible sounds from this collection that I got a chance to listen to. You can already hear him playing all those tunes. Not even his tunes. There were some covers as well of some tunes that he used to play and some blues, some folk music. And then later on, you start to hear the great voice that Bob Dylan became, you know, in the early 60s that's portrayed in that film, A Complete Unknown, that was so popular. It was so good, that movie. I went back twice. First, I saw it with a friend, and then I took my son. Was, you know, 26 years old. I took him to see the documentary on Bob Dylan so he could also, you know, understand the significance of this giant of music from the USA. 818-985-5735. We're offering this two CD set, $100 pledge. Support the radio station that gives you the voices like Noam Chomsky by calling 818-985-5735. Press option 2, or even easier, you don't even have to talk to anybody. Just go to kpfk.org/donate, and that's it. You can just pledge your amount, pledge $100, pledge whatever you can. Be a sustainer member. 818-985-5735. In the remaining minutes that we have, this is an opportunity to cast your vote, to say yes to alternative radio, to support this program that is brought to you by KPFK right here every Wednesday. 818-985-5735, 818-985-KPFK.
And your money is hard-earned. We appreciate it. You work hard for your money, and we're asking you to give what you can by calling 818-985-5735. Option 2. You know, this money doesn't go into saunas and hot tubs on the roof of the building. It goes into engineering. It goes into web tools, staff, equipment repairs, engineering, the tower. All these are real costs in running a community KPFK. As the manager says, let's stop patching holes and start rebuilding. You know, we're asking you to step in, not out of guilt, but because the alternative would be losing one of the truly independent media spaces left in Southern California. Help us hit 500 sustainers. Help us end the year strong. You can do it. We can do it. It happens one at a time. Don't delay. Don't procrastinate. Don't put it off till next week or next month or next year. The time to do it is now. Ahora, no luego. 818-985-5735. 818-985-5735.